It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azure Talon? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
William.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you a question. You ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight?
Not to my recollection.
Me neither. Let me ask you another question.
Okay.
Did that line originate in the Tim Burton Batman? Or is it from somewhere?
My impression at the time and still is that it came from somewhere, but I could not right at this moment tell you where.
That's where I am, but it has very much that impression. Because if it's not from another reference, that is some wild dialogue. Like the level of detail. Like if they just said, "You ever dance with the devil?" like that, I'm like, that could have been a spontaneous thing and it fits the vibe or whatever. We have to get into not just moonlight, but pale moonlight. I'm like, if that's not referencing some T.S. Eliot shit or something, like it's so purple, it's so florid to just be a throwaway. And that's the only part. I mean, I guess spoilers for Tim Burton's Batman. That's how Batman knows who he is, because he said it. He says it multiple times, which also is weird. That's like his catchphrase.
Yeah.
His catchphrase is a rhetorical question about dancing with the devil under very specific lunar conditions. Like, if that's not a reference, it may have ruined that movie for me. That may be all I'm going to be able to think about now.
I remember when I first saw it, because I saw the film in the theater, and I thought that revelation's pretty weak. Like, you want me to believe that this guy says this every time he shoots somebody? It's such a weird thing to say, and I don't know, it just didn't make sense.
I want to believe he says it all the time. He says it to the cashier at Aldi when he's getting his change back, like just all the time.
I just thought that was a weak story element, but I mean, it was memorable.
I disagree.
It was memorable for sure.
Maybe that's it. Maybe the first draft was like, "You ever dance with the devil?" And that was how he knew. And everybody's like, "That doesn't tell you anything. Anybody could say that." They're like, "Okay, we're gonna punch it up in the moonlight." Like, okay, pale moonlight. And he says pale every time. Like, okay, yeah. That is pretty specific. I would know that's the dude who killed my parents.
If he yes. said that. That like, was what the device was.
If he's like, "You ever dance with the devil?" It's like, in what context? Where are you where this devil dancing is happening? Huh? Tell me more. You remind me of somebody.
I mean, it was just if they were going to come up with a way for him to recognize him, that he wouldn't have recognized him earlier, right? Surely they could have come up with something better than that. But
it's become so iconic, and
yeah,
yet
that too, yeah.
I'm like, that was the thing just today, it just popped into my head because it does sometimes, and I was like, why are those words together? I was like, we all in the theater at the time, I was younger than you, because I am younger than you, I thought it was kind of badass. Like, it's just the level of like poetic, and like it's a sentence that with absolutely zero reflection sounds incredibly cool. But then you're like, huh, without any context, it's basically gibberish. And there is no context. Again, unless it's referencing something.
Well, even if they were going to have him say something, it could have, like you said, it could have made more sense. Like, you know, I don't know what, like ready to meet your maker or
who loves you, baby.
Do you have any last words or something?
Bazinga. I'm just a girl who can't say no. How about them Mets?
You want fries with that?
You want fries? yeah, so many options. And they settled on, this is how the pitch meeting went. They're sitting around and they're tossing these around. And then one of them's like, you ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? And they're like, what the fuck did you just say?
Well, then they even had...
I genuinely don't know. I just did a sort of a Mad Lib in my head. I don't know what I said either.
And then they had Jack Nicholson sort of try to explain, oh, it's just something I like to say. Nope, doesn't work. Not even coming from Jack Nicholson. Nope. That's stupid. No.
Here's the thing. I believe Jack Nicholson would go around saying that at random. I do not believe the character he plays within the Batman movie would do it. But Jack Nicholson, I would buy.
Fair enough.
Because when you hit a certain level of wealth and fame, you just do shit like that. You're just like, this is my thing now. If I was slightly less rich or slightly less famous, people would mock me for it, but they won't. It's kind of like, I forget who the band was, but supposedly, so you know how acts have writers in their contract? A writer is like, if I'm performing at your theater, you have to have 4 bottles of Dasani water for me and
sure,
half a pound of cold cuts in a brown paper bag or whatever. There was some band that used to specifically order, among other things, a bowl of M&Ms with all the green ones removed.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
And supposedly it was because they could then look at a bowl of M&Ms, and if there were no green ones in it, they knew everything else would be fine.
Interesting.
I feel like this is the same thing. I've decided to test my fame and influence. The way I'm going to do that is I'm going to walk around asking people, have you ever danced with the devil in, I don't know, let's say the pale moonlight? And that's going to be my thing. And if no one calls me on it, I know I've made it. If nobody's like, what the fuck does that mean? If nobody's like, are you feeling okay? What? Is that from something? What are you talking about? If nobody does that, I have reached the level of fame and fortune that I sought.
So let's back up a little bit, because I'm thinking about this here, this whole green M&M thing. Was that a reasonable conclusion to reach, do you think? For them,
not necessarily,
think that,
like, no. Also, I mean, it might also be an apocryphal story. I also, for those of you who like to freak out about people's writers, I have since discovered the celebrity in question has to pay for it all. They don't get this shit free. You as the venue have to set it up, but you charge it to them or take it out of their fee or whatever. So that's less. But no, I think you're right. Because, well, first of all, yes, on one level, it sounds really complicated. It's also low-hanging fruit, though. I know I'm going to be able to buy M&Ms. And I know pretty much any idiot that works here will be able to remove the green ones. So on a certain level, while it's finicky, it's easy to do. So I could make sure I do that one to look good and still fuck up a lot of other stuff.
That's what I'm thinking.
But I'm also wondering, and, you know, maybe I'm just not famous enough. Let's say that does answer the question of whether or not they got everything else right. why do you need to know that? I mean, it's good to know, but is there shit on your rider that you're like counting on? Maybe, I don't know, it's weird.
Well, I mean, I think it means
normally you would know if people did the thing you asked or whatever, because the thing you asked for is there.
Well, I don't think they were concerned about the riders being fulfilled. I think they were concerned about the normal things that you want to go write in a show or whatever. Like,
you, so this will, is just a genuine give a shit indicator.
Yeah. Like, if they care enough to get this right, then they probably care enough to just do their jobs. So we
okay,
can be
okay,
somewhat confident that they did that. I think that's the insinuation. I'm still not sure that it proves that at all.
It becomes one of those things. It probably did at some point prove that. And then as these things became more well known and people gamed them, it's like a lot of inventions of things that, like, oh, this frees us from advertising, or this frees us from politics, or whatever. And it does for a while.
I think if it were me.
And then eventually those things creep back in.
Yeah. I think if it were me, my approach would be, I'm not going to give you guys anything else to do so you can focus on the things I need you to do. Why burden you with a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't even have any impact on my show or my job or anything else? And potentially take you away from the stuff I need you to do to be ready for me to get there. I think that would be the best way to
As an outsider, the answer is, you think that stuff does matter. When you're famous and cool enough, you're like, you know what?
I sing
at my best when I've had some Gruyere cheese before. It's just a thing. I know it's weird and it's not huge. Like, I can still perform if I don't have it. But I do, if I've just got some Gruyere cheese taste on my mouth, I sing better.
Okay. I think it would make you phlegmy. I don't think you would really be able to.
See? now you're doing things. So now your writer at least says no Gruyere cheese.
No cheese.
No cheese at all. See?
If I see any cheese,
like,
I'm out.
Water seems legitimate. But then people get real specific about the brand and what it means and the whole deal.
I think people do get superstitious. I think it's like baseball players, you know, it's like, well, I had a really good show when, you know, there was a box of donuts from this place. So make sure there's, and they're not even going to eat them. It's just, they get superstitious. It's like, that helps.
Just take
out
the same box around it. I'm not superstitious, but I am kind of stitious.
You're kind of stitious?
I love that joke. I never get tired of that joke.
Only
thing I really enjoyed about the American version of The Office was that joke.
I mean, no,
I'm not stitious at all.
As a performer, I understand it, because there's so much you have to do to get psychologically prepared for any type of performance. I mean, like, you know, if you were going to play in a baseball game, I've done that, you know. All of these different ways that you perform in front of a crowd, I've done just about all of them. And I can tell you, you do have to be in a particular state of mind. And as a human being, you know, the objects around us have an impact on our state of mind. And if you're traveling, like a lot of baseball players and performers do, you're going to find yourself in environments that you didn't create or decorate or whatever.
Yeah.
And so there might not be the things around you that help you get into that frame of mind, and it is really important.
Get it.
It's really important.
When I perform beforehand, I like to kill a small animal. It can be a rodent, it can be a bird, whatever. With my own bare hands, see the life leave its eyes. I bring my own. I have them on the road. I don't know why other people can't do it. Bring your own damn M&Ms. Like, it's not tough.
I mean, I guess, sure, yeah.
And if it is so involved, if you're like, I can only perform well when I've killed an African elephant, maybe performing's not for you.
I think it's an underestimated, though. I mean, we're talking about superstition. I think it's an underestimated aspect of human life and behavior and therapy, you know, to discount the power of objects that might help a person feel comfortable, you know, like a rabbit's foot even, or a worry stone or things like that. I think.
Well, it's another side effect of the brain's desire to find patterns and things.
Right. And
omens and luck and good luck charms are sure. A very straightforward manifestation of
it. I mean, on one hand, a modern therapist doesn't, you know, think it's going to be necessarily healthy for a person to be superstitious or whatever. But the thing is, a person doesn't have to be superstitious. They just have to be a human being to draw comfort from this object, because that's what humans do. And there's nothing wrong with that. And if someone can be helped by, you know, here, take this stone. It's just a regular stone. There's nothing magical about it. But if you hold it in your pocket and you rub it when you're worried, if that helps you feel better, then what's the harm in it? There isn't any, of course. But I don't think, I think the industry of therapy needs to try to be more accepting of certain humans.
Sarah Industrial Complex is how we like to call it.
I think they need to be more accepting of basic human tendencies and just be okay with, you know, people wanting to be surrounded by certain objects or wanting to do certain rituals before certain things. I think ritual is another thing. I mean, ritual is not something I lean on a lot, but I've seen it help a lot of people. And I think that's, you know.
Symbolic thinking is some powerful shit, but it's important to always remember that it is symbolic thinking.
Well, all thinking symbolic, but I know what you're talking about.
Not mine.
I know what you're talking about. There's a danger of, you know, well, there's a lot of dangers, but there's dangers with prescribing medication. There's dangers with, you know, having a person do the cognitive behavioral therapy thing of writing down their thoughts and feelings. I mean, everything's a risk. You just have to ask yourself.
Let's just get rid of it. I recently listened to Janine Garofalo say she doesn't have kids and she doesn't want kids because she's risk averse. And I was like, I think that's the best and most succinct explanation I've ever heard for not having kids. Because there is nothing but risk in those goddamn little babies.
Lots of risk. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, lately it seems like there's a lot of conversation in the public sphere about that where risky things are considered like immoral. Well, drug use, for example. Drug use is risky, but it's not immoral. You won't even necessarily get addicted or have any type of issues. There's a lot of people that use all kinds of different drugs therapeutically and successfully. And it's risky. There's a risk associated with it, but it's not immoral. And it seems like a lot of people
obsessed with drugs.
People can't tell the difference between something that's simply a risky behavior and something that's like an actual immoral behavior.
We didn't talk about it on the podcast, but I have told several people about when you and I had to talk about drugs and I saw you get legitimately angry on like a professional level.
Angry about what?
I believe you said in 50 years from now, people are going to be prescribing small doses of psilocybin and it's going to do a lot of good.
I hope so.
And it's like the most pure anger I've ever seen from you. Like it wasn't born out of grief or anything. It was your version of just like, God damn it. It was pretty amusing.
Amusing? Why was it amusing?
It's like if you saw Teddy Ruxpin cuss somebody out. It's just adorable.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast that gives you an extra day's grace period when you overdraft your account. We help you out with that. I am Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 605. And I sincerely hope you're not one of the, I sincerely hope you're not one of the Americans who would benefit from medicinal, what am I trying to say? Psychedelics that are not available to you because of stupid government regulations. Needless suffering.
I think I'm
needless.
Right. I don't know.
Needless suffering. That's what I was angry about.
Do it like this.
And I'm still angry about it. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
If you're just joining us, we are a pro-drug agenda podcast. That is our whole deal. How to get you high as a kite and look good doing it. No, we have a hat. It's magical in that it has its own email address. TheMagicalTalkingHat@gmail.com. People write into that email address with whatever the crap they want. Things that they are hoping to put out into the world to expand their knowledge, to make us do stupid things for their amusement, whatever. Sometimes just to ask us questions.
Yeah.
And the hat magically on its own forwards it to us and we read them and talk about them. Although we spend a tremendous amount of time not doing that, as evidenced by the fact that it's almost half over. And this is going to be a twofer. So... Yeah. Prep yourself, because next week I will be in Oregon, and I will not want to talk to William. So, how's your week been?
Well, aside from school, you know, and actually a lot of the stuff I'm reading right now is about, you know, drug interventions for certain things. So that's been kind of interesting. My brother from Alaska has been in town, and...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, I could only manage to find a day to set aside. I feel terrible about that. He's here for like 10 days or something, and I can only see him for one. But we went to all my other siblings, drove through town, picked me up, and we went to, we went to LeClaire, the first place we went, but the place that everybody would know that I'm most interested in was Dyersville. We went to the Field of Dreams because my brother from Alaska had never been there. So
I drove by Dyersville on my way back from Wisconsin.
Oh yeah, you probably did. But anyway, it was cold, but it was fun. I know all five of us were there and had a great time. We were there for a long time. In fact, one of my brothers said, I think this is the longest I've ever been here. Usually when you go to the Field of Dreams, you look, oh, here it is, there's the house, wow, just like in the movie, bye, you know. But we were there for a good hour. We played some ball. I brought my mitt and ball and my wooden bat, and you know, we just did all kinds of stuff there before we left, and it was real fun. It was a great time, and I had some really good conversations with my brother. He's been working in prisons for a few years. Have I ever said that before? That he's a prison guard, or he was a...
I think that sounds familiar.
I think he told me they don't like...
They have prisons in Alaska? I thought Alaska was just a big prison.
He said they don't like Australia. He said they don't like being called guards. Prison officers.
Correction officer.
Yeah, correction officer, yeah. And so there was a time when he first started that he handled... Like there are certain officers that are assigned to discipline, responding to disciplinary situations.
Spankers. Yeah. Okay.
No. And he did that for a while, and then he wasn't doing that, but now he's doing it. Like he's been promoted into this position where he's like doing it full time. He's a sergeant now and all this other stuff. And boy, he just had a lot of interesting stories and insights, because he does an odd sort of therapy in a way, right? I mean, you know, he's trying to figure out what's going on with these men when they act out in certain ways, and what would be the best thing to help them. You know, he doesn't just want to punish them, you know, he wants to help them work through it and alter those behaviors over time. And so he actually does a lot of things that I think anyone would regard as like therapy. And he's really good at it. And I found a lot of the things he had to say and his insights were really, really good and helpful. I think it will be helpful to me. So we had just a fantastic visit about that stuff. He's
take it with a grain of salt, people. His other brother works in a grocery store, and he thinks that's an awful lot like therapy too. It's just a thing right now.
Well, I mean, I don't think people think about what correction officers do and how they do their job and what kinds of things they have to deal with and what strategies and tactics they are not just trained in, but that they have to sort of come up with themselves. And
I definitely don't think about that.
And the relationships they form. I mean, I worked with the prison ministry years ago, and I learned quite a bit that I didn't know about how things work in prison, how inmates interact with one another, how officers interact with the inmates, how visitors have to do things, and the knowledge that they have before they're even allowed in. I mean, it's a very rich sociological and anthropological environment that I think a lot of people really oversimplify in their minds.
No, I do.
And I think they do that because I think our culture doesn't want to come to terms with some of the things that we're doing wrong in our prison system. Yeah.
Hey, well, come on. Just because it's the only place where there is literally legal slavery. Just because the 13th Amendment that frees all the slaves specifically has a clause in it that says you can still enslave people if they're in prison, and we make tremendous use of that, to say nothing of privatizing the entire thing so that it's based on getting money rather than any sort of rehabilitation or even punitive development there. And just because we have stigmatized anyone who's ever been in prison at all and want them to just go away and never think about them, I don't know what you're saying.
I was gratified to find out that they don't have any privatized prisons up there.
Good.
And
I didn't want to be all judgy on your brother, but I was really hoping.
He's a libertarian-minded person, but I think he's not keen on privatized prisons because of all of the, I mean, there's a lot of perverse incentives right there. I mean, there's some of those in government run prisons too, unfortunately, that have to be dealt with. But you know, when your profit is tied to like how many people you have in beds and how much you're charging these people for phone calls and stuff, I mean, that's going to lead to bad things.
I mean, when your profit is tied to having a prison, I think that right there, profit incentivizing prisons sounds like a very bad idea too.
But so yeah, it's a fantastic visit. I learned a lot from him, and you know, I'm always grateful when I can interact with anybody, whether it's a member of my family or a friend or with a classmate.
Whenever anybody deigns to talk to him, he's just really grateful.
That too, but also, you know, people who have insight into, you know, how humans work, how you can better communicate with people, certain things, you know, how certain populations work, because that's another thing is, you know, you can consider the population of people who have been in prison for any significant time or had significant interactions with law enforcement that involve crime in prison and really jail, I guess, too, as a certain cultural population. I mean, they have something in common and have dealt with things in our society that the vast, vast majority of people have not. And they're going to see the world very differently because of that experience. Yeah, it's really insightful. And I mean, I hope that I'm sensitive if I have any clients that either are court mandated or maybe they've been in prison before and now they're out, that I'm sensitive to those multicultural aspects that pertain to their interaction with the criminal justice system.
I also hope you're sensitive.
Why do you make fun of me when I talk about these things? These are important things to me.
To be fair, it's a bit of meta discourse here. You're not necessarily talking about interesting things. You're talking about how you learned interesting things.
That's true.
So I'm just along for the ride. And I'm like, it sounds like you had a very rewarding experience.
I did.
Good job.
Sorry. Sorry about that.
I mean, we all do it. And also the alternative is for you to drill down into the specific fascinating details you got. And I'm not here for that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I know that. Anyway.
Our listeners might be, but too fucking bad.
How about your week? You probably have almost no time left.
I could mute him if I wanted.
You could.
I could do it. I could do it. The best part would be I suspect I could do it and not tell him. And it might be a while. It would probably notify you. But otherwise, I think we can get away with it pretty well. My week's fine. It's busy because we're planning our trip. And we're still recovering from our last trip. There's a lot happening. But pretty good. We're not watching or doing a whole lot. We are watching a show on Apple TV called Loot.
Mm.
It is a comedy about a very, 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 very wealthy couple. And they divorce. And the wife has no direction, and then she has this charity that she's had founded for years, and she decides she's gonna go get involved. And it's like a workplace / class-based comedy.
Mm.
And it has Maya Rudolph and Ron Funches and Joakim Boster and Michaela J. Rodriguez, which is what MJ Rodriguez goes by now. And I love all of these people. And it's worth watching because I love all of these people. It's not that great.
No.
It's good enough that we're watching it. It's entertaining. But it's not. I think part of the problem is we just came off of Woke. And Woke, which is also a sitcom dealing with social issues, actually dealt with social issues. And this show puts them in their plots, but isn't really addressing them. And so not that it should have the comparison, but it's not suffering the comparison well in our heads, but it's just not, it's not a real brilliantly done sitcom, but it's got a bunch of people in it that I like, and it's perfectly entertaining. So we do okay with it. And I actually watched a really good horror movie you can see on Shudder called Deadstream, that is a horror comedy about a YouTuber who was essentially canceled for a little while, but then got remonetized. And as a desperate bid to get back into his audience, he spends a night trapped in this haunted house, and then scary shit happens. But it was a little bit all over the place tonally, but it is kind of fun looking at influencer culture while also being one of those movies where the hubris of man against evil demons like doesn't go well, which, you know, I love those.
Yeah.
So that's been kind of fun. By the way, A Ghost Waits. That's the other movie on Shudder that you desperately need to watch. Besides Lucky, A Ghost Waits. That's the micro budget one that I told you I was really enamored with.
I have to note it.
A
Ghost Waits.
And then Lucky. Also Lucky.
Okay.
Last night we watched a movie that we'd been waiting for a while, but it suddenly showed up on Amazon. We didn't realize it. My Best Friend's Exorcism.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yep. Trish was a little sad. It's a horror comedy set in the 80s.
Yeah.
And apparently based off of a book.
Oh.
Yeah, I learned that at the end credits, based off of a quirk book, which I looked up quirk books, and they're just a publishing company. But they call all their books quirk books for some reason. They're the ones who have Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children or whatever too. But anyway, No, it is not good.
Oh.
Very much not. If you just watched the first act and the third act, I think you'd say, eh, it's fine. Whatever. Unfortunately, the second act is both real, real long and a real, real bummer.
Mm.
Like the second, this is a high school student gets possessed by a demon and we have to save the story. It's one of the standard horror movie tropes. And the first act is we find some damn reason to play with a Ouija board or go to a haunted house or, you know, save Candyman or what, something happens so that we get possessed. And then the second act is the, you know, Sally Huzitz has been acting real weird. And she's done her hair differently. And often, for some reason, she's sexier now. Although that's not always the case. Sometimes she's grosser now, depending on what kind of movie we're doing. And, like, when she walks by plants, they die. And, like, the dogs are scared of her. And she's just not acting herself. This version of that was just this big, long, stretched out thing of, like, wow, it's shitty to be a teenager. And also, wow, shitty. Teenagers are also very shitty. Like, and it was just like, here's how this sucks for our protagonist. And look, oh, here's how this sucks for all these other people we know. Although in some cases, they also kind of sucked. And so they brought this on themselves, but it still sucks. And really, I'm just sad. Also, it wants you really, really hard to know it's the 80s. It's one of those movies. Like, it's really big on, like, oh, we're in the past. And here's, you know, just references nonstop all the time. And it does twig on the fact that homophobia was way more in vogue in the 80s. But it pushes that button hard a lot to the degree that it's some kind of some plot point is the homophobia. But not in a way that I'm like, this is a metaphor for being in the closet or anything, you know, useful like that. It's just a lot of teenagers making fun of other teenagers for doing something that they think is gay. Also, have you ever seen a movie?
Yeah.
Then you've seen literally every scene and everything and every line that happens in this movie.
Yeah.
It is incredibly generic and cliche and has been done before. Also, there's a scene where the demon is trying to take over our victim. Because that's the thing, too. The only way you can do a possession thing is they're not all the way possessed yet. It goes through, like, phases. They're only mostly possessed. Then you can do. And so there are points in the movie at which we see our victim falling more under the spell of the demon. I've noticed lately in a lot of horror movies, they do that thing where someone's sleeping and somebody pulls the covers off them slowly. Almost always a sexual connotation. Not always, but almost always. And also, always a woman in the bed or girl. You never see that with a dude. Ever. And I think that's incredibly creepy. But anyway, there's a scene where the victim's house has a burglar alarm and it goes off and the parents are trying to stop it. And in the meantime, she's upstairs being attacked by the demon. And there's nothing explicit happening. Nothing like that at all. It's very just like the bed's moving. But it sure as shit looks to me like a rape scene. And at that point, I was like, one more thing, movie, and I'm done. But they didn't do one more thing. And in fact, the third act had some pretty fun bits in it.
I know a woman who claims that happened to her, the whole sheets being...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've heard of that from a lot, but you know, but do you know any men?
I don't.
Mm-hmm. This is the deal. I watched a movie recently where we had two daughters to this woman, and somebody was doing the sheet thing with the like 9-year-old, and I was like, "Oh fuck, do not! I will stop you immediately." But it didn't. Nothing happened with it, so that was good. But nowadays, anytime I see that sheet pulling thing, I'm like, "This is gonna be a sex thing, isn't it?" Anyway, my best friend's exorcism could not recommend. Sorry. But Deadstream was kind of funny.
We should make a movie called My Best Friend's Exorcism. Which one of us would be possessed?
That depends on what kind of range you're willing to exhibit acting wise. Oh. I think the victim of the possession would have to say some lines that you would be uncomfortable with.
Yeah, probably, maybe.
But then again, The Exorcist might also say some lines that you'd be uncomfortable with.
Well, yeah, but if you're the one who's possessed, and I'm just your best friend concerned about my possessed best friend, I can just say the things I normally say. Who would we get to play The Exorcist? Azure Talon. Have Azure Talon come in and play The Exorcist. That would be great. We can get all the Hatters to come in and play characters in our movie about my best friend being possessed. How would you get possessed? Would you be one of those spirit board situations? Or
I mean, I literally sleep on a Ouija board.
Oh,
like,
well,
it's my pillow. So.
Okay.
And we'll my head moves around. And yeah.
Seems like we should be more creative. We should be more creative. What if you were going to sort of accidentally do something to get the spirits all stirred up, what would you do? Like,
I mean, in my case, the standard big one, if you're like staunchly atheist, is I summon and invoke all the dark and evil powers. Come at me now. Do your worst. I abjure thee. I mock thee. I claim you unsuccessful. Come on, devil. Come get me right now. Do it.
Okay. All right. So we'd be doing a podcast and you'd be mocking everybody who believes in this stuff. And you'd say something like that, but then you'd get possessed. Is that what you're saying? Here we go. We're not making the movie right now.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I thought this was like a sizzle reel or something.
I know. That was good.
I was getting excited.
You know, put a pin in that, but.
I mean, it's probably not great for audio listeners.
We could work with this and we could get everyone to come in.
For those of you not watching the video, my head spun around 360. It was awesome.
We could get Jazz to come in. I think Jazz should play the, because, you know, there's always, when they call the paranormal team, there's always a psychic. I think Jazz should play the sidekick.
Oh my God. You're thinking the same thing I am, aren't you? You're thinking of her as the little person from Poltergeist.
I wasn't, but now I am.
I absolutely.
No, I wasn't thinking of that at all.
There's dark spirits here. Like the...
I was not thinking that at all. I was just thinking.
You said Jazz should be, and that just popped into my head immediately.
I mean, I hope I wasn't thinking that. I think
probably
I was
because
just...
I'm fairly convinced that actual woman is probably her cousin.
Probably. No, I was just thinking that would require a certain note that I know Jazz could hit as an actor.
I just always think of Jazz as having esoteric knowledge that we don't.
Maybe that's so part of it too.
It matches immediately.
She's like. You know, when I try to think of someone who embodies Abraham Van Helsing, yeah, she comes to mind right away as the person.
What the
who
hell? Would... I was watching something the other day that had really sad taiko drumming in it, and I was like, Jazz would be disgusted. What was it? because it was something kind of like supernatural, because they were doing like some sort of evil spell or whatever, but it was it had an Asian vibe and they had taiko drummers, but it was just like boom boom. And then they, what was it? That's so weird that I don't remember. Y'all watch She-Hulk?
Yeah, but I think there's been one or two episodes we've missed.
Well, it's done now.
Yeah.
As of a week ago, the last episode aired.
Maybe we've just missed the last one. Maybe it was just.
I'm going to be very curious when we do watch it, because it has had very polarizing response from what I can tell. On a personal level, I don't know how it's done professionally, but the people in my life who have seen it either think it's amazing and quite feminist, or they think it's really stupid and in some cases kind of anti-feminist.
Oh.
And so I'm curious to see. But
I mean,
we can all agree we love Tatiana Maslany, but that's not enough by itself.
I would say she's great. My opinion so far, and I think we've seen all but the very last one, is that it's not, the property is not really worthy of her talent. I mean, she's, and I don't think the effect that's used when she's She-Hulk really captures all the wonderful nuances of her performance. I mean, because when she's just her, she's just a joy to watch. She's such a good actor. And when she's Hulk, you just know that she's doing these little interesting things that the effect does not pick up. And so that's, as far as the feminist,
that's what Orphan Black is for.
Yeah. As far as feminist or anti-feminist or whatever, honestly, I didn't see it as either one. I mean, there are pro woman aspects to it, but there seems to be that in everything these days. It didn't seem especially feminist. It didn't seem anti-feminist, though. It just seemed like a normal thing with a female lead in it, that occasionally something would be said that seemed to be political oriented or whatever. But I mean, it was just a standard female-led show, as far as I could tell. And maybe that's not what people wanted. Maybe they wanted it to be more feminist or something. I don't know.
Well, someday I'll learn. Because someday we'll watch it.
I mean, I think we'll watch the rest of it. I don't think it was terrible. And I like her. I don't know if I really am into the whole She-Hulk concept that much, really. It's
fine. Trying to remember what the crap we watched recently that had the poor taiko drumming in it. I feel like that was a movie, and I probably should remember having watched it, but I can't remember what it is.
There's a show we've been watching that I will talk about, but I want to talk about it next week, because is next week technically our
Spooktacular?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I think it is. We didn't plan it well.
The one that's closest before, or do we care about
without
that?
Going like, over? It's Price is Right rules.
Yeah, it's Price is Right rules. Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah, because so after the fact, it's dumb. It's like when Simpsons do Treehouse of Horror on November 3rd. It's like...
Yeah. So, yeah, it's next week.
All right. Well, we're going to be there very soon. We should do an email.
Oh, you want me to do it? Okay.
I think I did it last time, so I think it's your turn.
I don't remember. This is from Maggie.
Good. Really? We're at Maggie's already?
Yes.
I thought we had one more before then.
No.
You're going with the oldest, right? I don't trust you.
Yeah, take a look. But I mean, right before that is Azure Talons with the Fjord thing.
Oh, you're not wrong. All right. There's a lot of questions here.
She has three questions. Should I just read them all at once?
Sure.
Okay. So the first one is, what is a personal opinion you have had and changed in the past year? The second one is, what is the best or worst advice you have gotten? And the third one is, what do you need to change about yourself or in your life? Well, those are, some of those are big questions. One of them, at least, is a huge question, it seems like to me.
I haven't had any opinion I have changed in the last year. Best advice I got was just be myself, and I don't need to change. perfect.
You are? Oh. Personal opinion. That's hard because in the last year I've been in school, and I'm certain there were a lot of misconceptions that I've had corrected as I'm studying certain things, right?
Well, I mean, I know, and I don't want to, but you have also personally come to revelations about yourself via therapy that strike me as, in some cases, opinion changes.
Sure, sure. Like,
that I think are pretty big.
Yeah, there are things about my past that I didn't, that if you'd asked me, I probably would have said, no, that didn't have a significant impact on me or my development or anything else. But now I think it did.
I think that's my answer too.
For example, my mom suffered depression when I was a kid. And, you know, it was severe depression. It was suicidal depression even. And I was very young. And if you'd asked me for a long time, you know, what was the long-term impact on me? I either would have said nothing, or I would have given some esoteric answer, like maybe it made me care about mental health or something like that. But I think it's been within the last year where I've stopped and thought, no, that specifically had an impact on me that was, you know, I don't know if I would characterize it as positive, negative, whatever, but something that I need to deal with that I didn't think I had to deal with before. So I think that's I don't know if that is that an opinion. I guess that's an opinion or an idea that I had one way of thinking about it before, and I really had to change my way of looking at it and in a significant way deal with that change of perspective, I think is what Maggie's getting at. So I think that qualifies.
Yeah. I think I've had a similar thing, I think it's very important. You say, I don't know if it was positive or negative or whatever, because I recently have had some revelations about the way I choose to interact with people and the way I forge friendships and what that means to me and whether or not that's a healthy perspective, whether or not that's a perspective shared by the people I'm in relationships with and sort of where that all comes from. And again, it's rooted in stuff that happened when I was very young and stuff that was involved in how I was raised that I've always thought was fine, but also very normal. And now I'm like, actually, and again, I don't want to say it's a bad thing, because again, it's also very, I keep saying again, it's very fundamental to the person I am. And by and large, I like the person I am. And so I don't want that to change or to have changed, or I'm not going to time travel this shit, because I like me and I wouldn't be me without it. But I do need to filter it through a critical lens now that I didn't before and realize what that means and what impact that has, that I have on other people because of this. But that might not be the big one. The biggest opinion that I have changed in the last year, it's not even that long ago, about, I want to say a month and a half, 45, 50 days ago, back then at least, I really believed very strongly in this woman named Liz Truss. And I thought she was the best thing that could ever have happened to the UK government. And now I and Liz have had to come to terms with the fact that actually she might be the worst.
Your commitment to sarcasm is as strong as ever. I see.
I had to pick 45 days because apparently she was in office for 44. My favorite bit on Twitter, Victoria Corin Mitchell says, in the future, the fact that Liz Truss spoke, gave the speech at the Queen's funeral is going to be an amazing trivia question.
And that she's because the last
Prime Minister. She was only PM for 44 days, and she's the one who spoke at the funeral.
But also, she's the last Prime Minister to meet her.
Also true.
She met the Queen, and then it wasn't.
And then ruined the country.
It's like a couple weeks later or something that Queen had died. It was really soon.
And that proved to be the least of the UK's problems.
Yeah. Best or worst advice. Yeah.
Advice is tricky because I don't listen to it.
I don't either, really. I mean, I shouldn't say that. That
is so not true. I gave you tons of advice and you at least pretend to listen to it.
What I mean is, when someone gives me advice, which I'm not always sure I even register it as that, I think about what they're saying and I either decide, oh, that's a good idea, I'll do that, or not. But I never think of it as me taking their advice. I always think of it as, this piece of information came my way. I considered it. It seemed valid to me. And so I kind of went with it. And in that way, I don't really credit, or I don't give anyone credit or blame for anything that I do, because as far as I'm concerned, I did this. And just because it was a suggestion someone else made and I decided, hey, that sounded good, that doesn't really mean it.
That's their why you're never really fazed when I tell you that I made you and I can break you, and you're always like, all right, so let's rephrase this then. What is the most or least valid piece of information that someone gave you on how to live your life?
Well, I mean, I do remember specific things that have happened. Like, I tell stories all the time about how, you know, when my grandfather died when I was 2 years old, I asked Mom if we'd ever see him again. And she said, I think so, because he was a good man. I remember that.
Yes.
And in a way, it wasn't advice, but it was something that registered with me and shaped the way I thought about things till to this day. I remember my uncle, when the Pope came and visited Iowa in the 70s, my uncle was flying in on the same day, and he came, and I said something to him about the Pope's going to be here. And he said, I don't care. I said, what do you mean you don't care? He said, well, he's no closer to God than I am. And I wasn't, you know, I'm not Catholic. I didn't really think of the Pope as any closer to God than anybody else. But the notion that other people did think that about the Pope, and that in a way I was sort of jumping on that bandwagon by having as much interest in it as I had, without being critical about it.
Such a papal stooge. Always happened.
I just, when he said that, I realized, oh, yeah, there's this sense that some people are closer to God than other people, and that why it, you know, that doesn't even really make sense, does it? So I remember that. I remember, I could probably name lots of things, but they're mostly like that. They're not so much a person giving me advice as they're people.
A fun fact, the hymn Nearer My God to Be used to be titled Nearer My God Than Susan.
So, but advice, I mean, I think also, I think after a while, people who knew me stopped even trying to give me advice because they knew I was just going to do whatever I wanted anyway. Yeah. I mean, I've even had people tell me that, like, they wouldn't give me advice because they knew I would just do whatever I wanted anyway.
I am a huge, and it came up today, actually. I am constantly marvel at the wisdom and usefulness of talking with other people about their therapy experiences. Because so many things that other people's therapists taught them about how to deal with their issues, they have told to me, and I have found ways to make use of that as well. Not always, everybody's different. But even just today, my therapist brought up a way of communicating that involved, you tell people you want to communicate, and then you tell what you hope we're going to get from this and then what you're afraid will actually happen. And it's a way to discuss difficult or important things. And I'm the one who told her about it because a friend of mine learned it from their therapist and it's still being useful. All the stuff about boundaries that first came up when somebody else talked about their therapist doing that. And I was like, that sounds really good for you. I don't think it's going to matter for me. That's not really my thing. Yeah, no, all of it's about boundaries. All of therapy is about boundaries. Don't be convinced otherwise. And so I find this to be very useful, is hear how other people are having therapy experiences, because so much of that can be useful for others.
Well, right. And like when my brother was talking about his experiences with inmates and stuff, I got a lot out of that. I mean, none of it
changed the way you deal with inmates in your day to day life.
It's none of it's advice, but it's helpful, like advice, better than advice, I think. I mean, I don't mean to be down on advice or anything. I just
better than advice, the new plant based advice substitute.
Yeah. What do you need to change?
Okay, this is tricky because my short answer to this is nothing. But I don't mean it the way you would expect me to mean it.
Yeah.
But I am not at a point in my life where I am confused or adrift or unsure of what I want to be doing. I know what I want to be doing. I am not always happy with my life and my performance within it on a given day or even a given week, sometimes even a given month. But it's all the pieces are there. And so the important thing that I need is just the perspective to know, keep trying for what you want. And if you sucked at it today, you do it again tomorrow. And if you were really good at it today, you do it again tomorrow. It's, you just keep at it. And you got highs and lows. I'm real big on highs and lows. And it, none of that changes what you do tomorrow. And I know what my goals are in life. I know what I'm shooting for. And there's not really anything in the way of those goals except sort of me.
Yeah.
And again, that's mitigated. I know I have unhealthy behaviors. I also have priorities, which vary. But I've said this before, and it feels weird because it feels sort of braggy or at least not as helpful to people. But I have such a stupid amount of control over my life. I have so few outside influences that mostly have to do with being affluent, white, and not having a job. And a dude. And some of those are societal privilege. Well, okay, all of those are societal privilege. But a lot of it, I mean, a lot of people have a lot of these. The not having a job is a very big one. I don't have any bosses. I don't have any schedules that are like... But more, the older I get, the more I'm like, the things I do are up to me. And in general, the consequences of them are based on the things I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if I had a bad day, I can usually stop and be like, I did this. Well, don't do that tomorrow.
Right.
Like, doctor, today my arm hurt when I did this. Well, guess what?
Don't do that.
And it's stop the... The one thing I took away from, I used to have this real head so far up his own butt boss who would make me read the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People and then discuss it with him. And in general, that book is trash. But the one thing I did take away from it is the circle of concern, circle of influence thing. You draw a picture that's all the stuff you're concerned about. And then there's a picture that's usually smaller in there that says all the stuff that you can actually influence. Yeah. And the ideal, it's not a given and it's not necessarily easy, but the aspirational ideal is to get those the same size, to get those where you are not particularly worried about shit over which you have no influence. And it's aspirational. You're never going to get there. I am frequently worried about geopolitical things that I really have virtually no influence on, if any. But the more you try and do that, and the more you say, okay, I can't control this, so fretting about it will not be helpful. The more you don't spend time ruminating, that's a fun word I've learned.
Yep.
Ruminating. It's essentially being bothered by shit that's already happened. Spending time going over things that made you sad that have already happened.
Yep.
Not useful or healthy. And these are all things that I try and minimize. And I say all of this. I'm not saying I'm good at any of this. But I'm very much aware this is what I'm shooting for. And I like to think over time I'm getting better.
Knowing is half the battle. G.I. Joe.
Pork chop sandwiches. All right. We're over time and we have to do another one of these. So, listen again next week. I'm not going to explain how the podcast works. You're not here for this. I hope the microphone is not picking up the sound of the cat puking. But I am wearing noise-canceling headphones, and I could hear it. So, sorry. It was Ezzy. She pukes a lot, is how she expresses herself. Go to the blog, themagictalkinghat.com, and give your opinions on the things we talk about today. We've had some doozies in terms of, like, opinions today. We have made some calls, and I want you in there telling us we are full of shit, or that you agree with us and we're a cult now. Either way.
We're a cult now.
Oh, I don't know. Sarah Industrial Complex. We're a cult now. And then there was another one in the middle that was really good. I can't. Oh, Nearer My God Than Susan. I don't know what to pick.
Oh, we're a cult
boiled
now.
For are choice.
I really like that one. I don't know why, but I do.
It is nice, but my heart might belong to Sarah Industrial Complex. I don't know. Anyway, go to aethertheater.com and look at all of William's shit. He is prolific, if nothing else. Sorry. He is prolific. Nothing else. And I, on the other hand, am not even that. I've written a book. It's called Odd Wings. You can find it at smashwords.com. If you look up Odd Wings or Anthony K. Parsons, you'll find it. I am working on a sequel, but who knows? I could be dead tomorrow. I could be dead before this podcast, before the next episode. It'll be rough for William, but, you know, I touch this computer and it zaps me, and I don't understand how life and death or podcasts work. Either one.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.